WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sex is the cause of immense anxiety in our culture. Leonore Tiefer explores why in her new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. She says there is so little honest discussion about sex that many, perhaps most people, have false expectations and feel insecure and deficient. Her book puts our sexual attitudes in a larger social and cultural context. Tiefer is an associate professor of urology and psychiatry at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She's taught sexuality courses for medical and nursing students, evaluated almost 2,000 patients with sexual complaints, provided sex therapy and psychotherapy for individuals and couples, and she briefly wrote columns for newspapers and magazines. We're going to have a frank conversation about sexuality and cultural attitudes about sex, so be advised. I asked Leonore Tiefer if she was surprised at the controversy that surrounded former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elder's comments about masturbation.
I was so shocked and I was so sad, but I can't say no that I was honestly surprised, because masturbation is a topic that's so incendiary. You know, people said that it was just used as an excuse and people were going to try to get rid of her sooner or later. But I wasn't surprised that it was masturbation that was the final straw. You know, when you talk to John Gagnon about the University of Chicago study and mentioned that that was the most difficult topic for his interviewers to talk to their subjects about, and that masturbation questions were the first ones actually taken out of his survey by the federal government, all of this is an indication that masturbation is an incendiary topic. It's something that is a source only for humor, for giggles, rarely, if ever, for just regular conversation and, God forbid, for sex education.
Why do you think people are so uncomfortable talking about masturbation?
I think that there are several reasons. The one that people will give you straightforward is that there are many places in religious literature and doctrine that says that it's wrong. And so people are very comfortable saying this is bad, this is wrong, and they can cite chapter and verse, literally, to support that. But what I think happens is that so much of sexual discussion is tinged by embarrassment and discomfort and shame and awkwardness, that it's a relief to have a topic where you can say, and it's wrong, and somehow justify your embarrassment and awkwardness and shame and discomfort. I think that masturbation symbolizes sex for the sheer pleasure of it. It's just unbridled pleasure. It's got no other justification. I mean, you can read advice books, and they will try to dignify it by saying, and if you masturbate, you'll get in touch with your body, and this will help you when you finally meet Mr. Right. But the fact of the matter is, what you learn about your body in masturbation is less than what you learn in the shower. So I think the only justification for the thing is that it feels good. And our culture has a long tradition of not feeling so good about saying that it's perfectly all right to just engage in activities that have no, sexual activities particularly, that have no purpose, no dignified love, bonding, sanctity of marriage, nothing other than it just is a nice thing to do. It helps you go to sleep. It whiles away the time. It reduces anxiety.
I always figured one of the reasons why people are so embarrassed talking about it or admitting to it was it was like worse than saying you didn't have a date on a Saturday night. You know, that like you had no other option.
Yes.
And it said something bad about you.
Yes. I mean, the implication is that it's a second best kind of a thing, and that anybody with any social qualifications at all would have another another person to do this with and wouldn't have to do it alone. It's like drinking alone or anything alone. I mean, when you think about it, our society is very oriented towards getting people somehow to value doing stuff together more than to doing stuff alone. And sex is certainly one of them. But the idea is that you only have so much to spare. And if you're going to masturbate, it's obviously because you don't have a partner to do it with. But Gagnon's research showed that that wasn't true, that sex is more a sort of a more you get, the more you want kind of a thing. The less you get, the less you want, rather than, you know, there's exactly 72 acts per month available and you can distribute them however your life allows you.
Now, as part of your work as a sexologist, you've worked with a lot of individuals and with couples.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if one or both members of a couple are masturbating, that maybe is a sign that there's something wrong in the sex life of the couple?
Look, Terry, the rule in sex is anything is possible. So if you ask, could it maybe be a sign? Yes, anything could be a sign. Sex is a social phenomenon that is done for many motivations, many reasons, fits into lives in an infinite number of ways. So could there be a sign that it's a problem? Yes. Could there be a sign that one person has a problem and the other one doesn't? Yes. Anything is possible. But is it automatically a sign of that? No.
Now, you actually make a connection between crusades against pornography and fears of masturbation. How are the two connected in your mind?
Well, the main use of pornography is for masturbation. Everybody knows that. When you see all of this stuff, the New York Times, I mean, I can't believe the New York Times has gotten on a thing where it actually uses the word smut in its headlines. Somehow I thought the word smut had gone out a long time ago. But anyway, when you see all of this anti-pornography news and legislation and tirades and so on, they never talk about masturbation. They talk about how it harms people's minds, warps them. They go out, they do bad things, but they don't actually discuss that the main use is for masturbation. And I think that a lot of the fuel for the anti-pornography crusades comes from what we were talking about earlier. This sort of almost universal anxiety and awkwardness about admitting that people masturbate.
As a sexologist and feminist, what are your thoughts on the feminist campaigns against violent pornography?
I think that they're misdirected. They say that pornography is the cause of misogyny, of anti-woman beliefs, and of violence against women. And I just don't think that's right. I don't think there is research literature to support that. I think that pornography is a convenient scapegoat. And I am a feminist, and I am opposed to violence against women with every fiber of my being. But I don't think that going after pornography makes a lot of sense. There are so many other social institutions that are contributing to violence against women and to general women's oppression, that going after pornography is just something which then puts you in the camp of the religious right, a lot of other groups that are themselves not in support of women's freedom and women's progress. I think it's a dangerous line to pursue. And I'm not persuaded by it, and I think that it's going to be regarded as a cul-de-sac by history, you know, sort of in the same way that prohibition was a big campaign in the first feminist movement in the late 19th century because alcohol made men brutal and men were brutal against women, and so in order to protect women, we had to eliminate alcohol. And you know, that just was seen as a cul-de-sac, ultimately.
Do you ever prescribe pornography for your patients?
I don't prescribe anything. I suggest a lot of things. I'm in the business, in a lot of cases, of introducing people to kind of the world of sexual discourse that's larger than, you know, the few sentences that their parents or friends might have given them, that you have to do it or don't do it, or, you know, do it whenever he wants to do it, or, you know, simple-minded things like that. I'm in the business of talking about pleasure, talking about the body, about the skin, about interaction, about eye contact, about dancing, about fantasy, and about talking about sexual stores where you can buy books and pictures and edible underwear, and talking about sex as something to laugh about, something that's spiritual, something that can partake of many aspects of human potential. So pornography as visual and written material that turns people on is something that often comes up in the conversation, along with tons of other things like Ravel's music. It builds to a climax over and over again. I used to play this music to my undergraduate classes and say, now that's erotic. I mean, this is auditory pornography.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leonore Tiefer, and she teaches in the Department of Urology and Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She's the author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Leonore Tiefer, author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. You've written that suppression of pornography deprives people of learning more about the human imagination.
Yes.
What do you feel you've learned about the human imagination from pornography?
Well, I've learned it in the same way as in novels or other fictional depictions, how motives and individual personality expressions are sort of converted by the fictional imagination, my fiction, you know, the person, not always the author so much, but the reader's imagination. Let me give you an example from a case that I had where a woman, I can't tell all the details, just it would take 4 hours, but suffice it to say that she was not having a good sexual relationship with her husband, but she was masturbating, and her favorite fantasy had to do with her dancing naked in a room filled with sort of seedy men. It was a seedy room, a crummy carpeting, and everybody, you know, sort of had 2 days' growth of beard, and you could tell that the place smelled from beer, and it was like seedy, archetypal seedy. Well, we talked about that a lot, and it had a lot to do with her kind of... Like most women, wanting to be attractive, wanting to be powerful through being looked at. A woman has this sense that if she walks into a room, men should notice, men should get turned on, not necessarily wildly aroused, but a little bit turned on. But I mean, I would think that most women, heterosexual women, might think that if they were going to take their clothes off in a room and dance around, that it would turn men on. And I thought that this was a very empowering fantasy. Now, she initially saw it as degrading. I mean, why am I in this seedy room? Well, it turned out that this fantasy, that she didn't feel entitled to this sense of power. She didn't feel good about it. She came from a rather orthodox religious background, and certainly the idea of turning men on was not something she'd ever been given permission to feel powerful doing. So she had to do it in her fantasy in such a way that it was crummy, degraded, if you want to use the popular word, but seedy I like better. So she did it in this seedy way, in this seedy place, but by God, she got her power in there.
Do you find that the women who you see in your practice often have sexual fantasies that turn them on but also upset them?
Yes, well, like this one. This fantasy upset this woman quite a bit. She wanted, I don't know what she wanted to do, look like Annette Funicello dancing around or something, you know, something really classy or middle class upscale, not seedy.
Do you often hear fantasies that have to do with being raped?
Forced to do sexual things is a common element in women's fantasy.
But you're making a separation between that and the word rape.
Well... rape, what is rape? Rape is forced to be doing sexual things, but I guess I want to put it in that language, first of all, because the word, you know, the words we use in sex are so overdetermined. And you say the word rape, we have 42 million associations, and we're already polarized and holding our lances pointing towards each other. But if I say forced to do sexual things, well, at least that opens up a conversational area that's not already, you know, corralled and organized. A lot of times, fantasies of both men and women include being forced to do sexual things. And I think that that's because in our society, people do not grow up feeling just terrifically fine about doing sexual things, having oral sex, having sex outdoors, having sex with famous people. They're not encouraged. So people can have a perfectly undistorted, unsymbolic fantasy about skiing with the president, but to have a fantasy about having sex with the president, they might have to be forced to have sex with the president. So that's kind of how it works.
If someone has a fantasy of something that they know would disturb them in real life,
yes,
does that mean that the fantasy is a sign of some kind of pathology? I mean, do you think it's acceptable to have fantasies that may be pleasing to you as fantasies, but if it happened to you in real life, it would be absolutely horrible?
I think this is commonly what fantasy is about. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people's fantasies. This woman with the seedy dancing. I mean, if she was, you know, grabbed off of the street, stuffed in the back of a Buick and taken to a crummy motel and forced, I mean, this is what fantasy is about in sex.
Well, how do you explain that? I don't know if you can, but do you try to explain that?
To people, I tell them how it's just the mind's way of getting what it wants, but acknowledging that it doesn't feel entitled to get it.
One more question about pornography. How concerned are you about violent pornography where women are the victims?
I'm as concerned about it as I'm concerned about other violent expressions in society. I think there's too much violent movies, you know, people getting shot through the forehead with an AK-47. That's, I mean, disgusting, horrible. I deeply regret it. I'm concerned about all violent expressions, and I'm concerned about all degrading expressions. Women being used in advertisements for computers. You know, this woman will be happy to type on your computer for the next 60 hours. You know, nobody's going to be happy doing that. Their eyes and their hands are going to go to hell. So I think that there's lots of expressions of misogyny. Some are violent, some are not. And I'm opposed to them all, but I'm not in favor of censorship. I work with the National Coalition Against Censorship, for example, because censorship is one of the favorite ways of attacking sexuality, all kinds of sexuality. I mean, it starts with, hey, let's get bad sexuality, but then it's very hard to define what's bad sexuality. So then you get masturbation, because a lot of people are going to say that's bad sexuality, and then you get thinking about kids being sexual. Everyone's going to say, well, kids are not sexual, forget that. Anything to do with kids and sex is automatically bad. And, you know, it just spreads and spreads. So that what do you teach in sex education? You teach the lady has the ovaries and the gentleman has the testes. Thank you, class. I mean, that's all you teach.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sexologist Leonore Tiefer. She's the author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act, and other essays. I think a lot of middle-aged women now worry a lot about the loss of sex drive after menopause. And I think more and more women are using as estrogen replacement therapy.
Yes.
I wonder if you've seen those concerns expressed in your work,
sure.
And what your impressions are of estrogen replacement therapy.
Well, now I'm a psychologist, so I can't really speak with authority about certain medical aspects, but I'll say what I've seen from the women who come in to talk with me about their husbands and the couple's sexual problems. A lot of times, the focus, the maniacal focus on continuing to have intercourse as the sole form of sexual expression leads these women to feel that they have to get estrogen replacement therapy or they have to use estrogen cream or even non-estrogen vaginal lubricating cream in order to be able to continue having intercourse when intercourse is really not comfortable for them. Also, the issue of drive is a very interesting one because a lot of times if you're able to have intercourse and you've somehow done the erectile repair thing so the man is capable and you've got the grease going so the woman is capable, there's very little foreplay. And so any sort of arousal that might be slower on the uptake is truncated because, well, look, we can perform the thing and that's what we define as being normal, so let's get right to it and forget about all of this foreplay, which makes us anxious because there's no roadmap for foreplay the way there is for intercourse. Well, do you do the left breast first or the right breast or do you nibble the ear or what's the, and I have heard this many times. What exactly is foreplay, doctor? You know, what should I do first? Looking for a real roadmap. And, you know, it's like asking somebody, okay, here's the complete spectrum of solo piano pieces. What should I do first? Well, you know, if there were sexual coaches in the world, they could say, well, you know, try this for a couple of months and then let's move on and then let's move on. And there ought to be such people. I think there ought to be sexual coaches. But we don't have that, and I'm not in the business of telling people how to make love.
Leonore Tiefer is the author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. She'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with sexologist Leonore Tiefer. In her new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act, she writes about the anxiety and confusion that surround the subject of sex. Tiefer is an associate professor of urology and psychiatry at Albert Einstein Medical College. She's taught courses on sexuality for medical students and has provided sex therapy for individuals and couples. Be advised that we're having a frank conversation about sexuality. You write that for most people, sexual experience falls short of what they hoped for and what they believe others may be experiencing.
Yes.
What are some of the typical differences between the disappointments that men and women express to you?
I see men, patients, and they come in because they can't perform intercourse. They're having some sort of erectile difficulty most of the time. And so they focus their disappointment on somehow their performance inadequacy. That if only I could perform almost robotically or like an automaton, you know, every time without question, with complete confidence, without hesitation, then that would really meet their expectations. Whereas women come in, and again, these are not women who are coming in because they themselves have a problem. Maybe if I was working in a different place, hearing different stories, it might come across this way. But since the women I see are coming in without themselves necessarily complaining of a problem, they come in saying, all right, so we can have intercourse, so he has an erectile problem. Why does he have to avoid all sexual interaction? Why can't we have a little cuddle here and there? Why can't we have a little oral sex? Why can't we have at least touching and kissing and holding? So we can't do the whole thing, so who cares? I want to feel desired. I want to feel close. And I'm not getting that.
So do then you try to talk to the man about being more loving, even though, you know, being more physical, even if it doesn't lead to intercourse?
I used to.
You stopped?
What? I gave up. I only have one contact. Well, really two, or mostly one, interview opportunity with these men.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot change a lifetime of indoctrination in one conversation. It's really rude to even think that you could, because I was arrogant at the beginning. I thought, hey, these men don't know that cuddling is swell. I'm just going to tell them. Well, forget about it. You cannot change a lifetime of indoctrination with a single conversation. And so, you know, I toss it in. But they run right over it with their Mack truck of I've got to have an erection or I'm not a man, and they don't even hear you.
What about generational differences? Do you find that young people have a completely different set of problems than middle-aged people?
Yes. I think that young people are under much more pressure than older people because they see the sex in a relationship as a make-or-break element. They see the sex in terms of their own adequacy. They have much higher standards. You no longer just have to have intercourse and, whew, okay, I did that. I'm okay. I'm normal. Now you got to kind of be Nureyev, a little bit of foreplay, you know, and a little conversation and then a little oral sex and turn them around upside down. So the expectations are much higher. And there seems to be, you know, there's always a lot of people who are anxious and a lot of people who are just nervous, and so they're nervous about this. And so I wish that the people who were nervous could just scale down their expectations so sex shouldn't be such a big deal for them. They should go back to plan A where somehow, you know, just getting it done was adequate.
I think this leads us to the title of your book, which is Sex is Not a Natural Act. Why not?
I'm so glad you asked me that, because if there's one thing I feel I have to say that perhaps your average, ordinary sex therapist, is maybe an oxymoron, talks about, is I think that one of the most oppressing elements in our whole rhetoric about sexuality is the idea that it's natural. Natural meaning you don't have to learn, you don't have to practice, you don't need feedback. It's just like unrolling a carpet. There it is, and it's perfect, and that's the way it is, and don't worry about a thing. When the time is ready, honey, you'll do it. And that's just baloney. There's no red carpet in there. The whole thing is a complicated, kind of lifelong process of adjustment, adaptation, development, interaction. And it's extremely related to the culture and the historical period and the values of where a person and a couple are. So I think that if we were to see sexuality as fundamentally socially constructed, that we would have a much more robust attitude towards the need for sexuality education of a rich sort rather than just kind of a pathetic organ-grinding sort. And I think that we'd be much more interested in all of the different manifestations as expressions of the human personality instead of just pathology. You know, it's like if you think of sex like respiration, you got two choices. It's either normal or something's broken. But if you think of sex like music, well, then you're ready. You're interested in culture. You're interested in individual differences in breath control and hand span. You're interested in how many hours a week did you practice. You're interested in a lot of more interesting questions just than is it fixed or is it broken.
My guest is Leonore Tiefer, author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with sexologist Leonore Tiefer. You've said that you've seen men's sexual problems become medicalized.
Mm-hmm.
And you work in the Department of Urology.
Yes.
At a hospital and at a college. So mm-hmm. even your work is affiliated with something medical.
Right.
How have you seen that expressed?
It's really a process that's taken place over a period of 15 to 20 years where we began back in the beginning of the 70s with Masters and Johnson's research showing the biological changes during intercourse, during arousal and orgasm during intercourse. And it was somehow that gave legitimacy to medical people being authorities in the sexual field, but authorities with a very narrow focus, the focus on arousal and orgasm in intercourse. Well, over this period of time, a variety of techniques have been developed to help couples perform this rather narrowly constructed sexual repertoire more and more effectively. And more impediments to this performance have been diagnosed so that you can't get an erection for a variety of different reasons. This can be accurately diagnosed and treatments can be made available. The trouble is that it's always focused just on this very performance-oriented piece. And when I say the medicalizations, it's that the authority for fixing sexual problems has become located in the medical domain, but the medical people have a very narrow take on what sexuality is. The only thing that these men come in for, and the only thing that really is available to them, is this erectile repair service. And so cuddling is not covered by managed care, let me tell you, and it's not going to be covered by managed care, whereas erectile repair is going to be covered by managed care. So the medicalization, coming from kind of the legitimacy of very narrowly constructed biological research, is saying, this is what sex is, this is what we can fix, we are the people you should come to. Now, I'm afraid that the same thing's going to happen with women.
What are your fears about this medicalization happening to women?
This is now already we're getting into the realm of paranoid fantasy, so let's just be clear about that. There was an article in the New York Times sometime during 1994 that just put my hair on end. I mean, I couldn't get my hair to lie down for days. That a urologist was saying, you know, I know all about how to fix the penis now. I know all about how the particular blood vessels go and how the blood comes in and the thing gets engorged and so on. And the same thing happens in the clitoris. And I'm doing research on the clitoris, and I'm going to be able to treat the clitoris just the way we treat the penis. And I thought to myself, oy vey. People, women are going to come in, and they're going to be unhappy. They're going to need a, you know, they're kind of vaguely unhappy. It's sex is not what they thought it was going to be. It's not as successful as they want it to be, because in fact it can't be. And perhaps we can talk about that in a minute. But the expectations, I think, really exceed the capabilities of sex in some sense. But they come in with vague complaints, the way men used to come in with vague complaints. And the doctor says, oh, you have a vague complaint. You don't have a vague complaint. You have a specific complaint. It's called clitoral hyperpipopoplasia here. And a few little stitches and a little grease, and I'll send you on your way. They see sexuality as the performance of organs in the same way that they see breathing as the performance of organs. And I think that that's not the kind of thing that sex is. I think sexuality is more like spirituality and more like musicality and less like respiration and digestion.
That there's many different ways it can be expressed.
That's right. It's fundamentally a cultural phenomenon. Of course, it's done with the body. Playing the piano is done with the body. But when you open a book on music, the first chapter isn't the bones of the hands. Whereas if you open a book on sex, the first chapter is, and the clitoris is connected to the labia, is connected to... It's not about how human beings express themselves, how culture varies, how learning takes place, how conditioning takes place, how come people in India play the tabla and people in America play the snare drum. You don't see that in a sex book. You see, you know, the knee bone's connected to the ankle bone.
Leonore Tiefer is the author of Sex is Not a Natural Act. She teaches at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. This is Fresh Air.